Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder, we are Zooming on Tuesday afternoon. We've begun every show since March with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. You're probably ready to say, oh God, Arnie, can't we find something else? And I'll say, yes, after the election, we will find something else. But until the election, you will hear his voice begin my show every single day because it's the voice of a patriot. It's the voice of someone who's willing to speak truth to power. It's someone who basically got a perp walk out of the White House. It's someone who sort of assured his father during his testimony that it would be all right. And I so desperately wanted to tap him on his shoulder and say, I don't think so. So now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, impeachment hearings 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I really like David Atkins. He is a writer and activist from California. He's a contributor to the Washington Monthly's Political Animal. He actually was elected as a DNC member and is a president of the Pollux Group, a qualitative research firm. He is here as a writer. He is here as a writer at the Washington Monthly about a piece that we've been sort of dancing around a lot, but now we sort of get to sort of weigh in a way that I think is more fulsome and important because we get to look back as we look forward. The title of David's piece is Republicans Have Already Packed the Courts. It's up to Democrats how to rebalance them. And the press should not play accomplice to the GOP's efforts to change the subject. So let me welcome David to the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks.
So yesterday we had Matt Stoller on and he was talking about monopolies and antitrust. And he was saying, you know, they're about to sort of bring lawsuits against Google and all this other stuff. And he said, I really do care about the court. And I really do worry about what's happening with the imbalance on the court and we need to address it. But then he said something really interesting. And I think it's really important for us to sort of have this in the back of our heads as we're talking about maybe expanding the size of the courts, maybe term limits, a lot of other sort of variations on the theme. And that is, Congress hasn't been doing its job, David. It hasn't been passing legislation. It hasn't been doing the nitty-gritty of policy. And to a large extent, that's exactly what the Republicans want, because they don't believe in policy, they don't believe in regulations, and they see the court as a way to dismantle regulations, dismantle legislation. And even to some extent, I think they actually write legislation knowing that it probably will be ripe for adjudication because it doesn't have the clarifications that one needs. So in a lot of ways, they look at the courts as sort of now their handmaiden. And one of the things that Matt Stoller said is that this really is a message to Congress, if it turns out that the Democrats end up controlling and Biden wins, for us to do the real heavy lifting of actually writing legislation and not depending on the courts. That doesn't mean that the courts aren't important. So let's go back to this sort of toxic language that the media uses and Trump uses about packing the courts. And I think what you wrote was so important because you go back to what the Republicans have done over the course of really the last decade. You've explained what happened during the Obama administration, because if anyone understands the ideals of packing the courts and has done it to a level of perfection, it is the GOP. So what I would like you to do is, before we get into what Biden should do or the options on the table. Let's really explain to the American people what the hell the Republicans have done and how they've denied Barack Obama his ability to make appointments and what they have done with what they've put on the court. Because if you want to understand court packing, take a course with the GOP.
Yeah, look, I mean, this has been going on for decades, actually. The Federalist Society is one of the most, you know, damaging organizations in all of America. And much in the same way that Fox News has worked the refs for a long time, conservatives with regard to the courts and with regard to judges have been working the refs for a long time and sort of playing a topsy-turvy world, accusing normal kind of justices of having this massive liberal bias. While then pushing their own radical extremists and calling them originalists or constitutionalists or what have you. Leonard Leo, the Federalist Society, they've been doing this now for decades. So you get justices like Scalia or Clarence Thomas who are incredibly radical and they're not sort of originalists. They're not looking and talking about what originalism is and the fraud that is originalism. Would take a whole show in and of itself. But basically, these people are using whatever arguments are necessary by pretending that they're peering into the minds of the founders in order to achieve whatever conservative policy aims they want to achieve in the moment. So
if I was an originalist, for example, then wouldn't I then say to the NRA, fine, as long as you hold muskets, you're good. Give me a, I mean, that was what was in their minds. They never imagined an AK-47. They didn't imagine, you know, maybe someday eventually personal atomic devices. They didn't imagine the arsenal that we're talking about. And they also imagined it in the context of a well-regulated militia that for some reason, the originalists can't read those words. So it's so interesting to me, not only do they cherry pick, but their definition of originalism changes on their ideology.
Exactly. Well, I mean, obviously, there's all sorts of things from social structures to the technology of guns to everything else that's extreme to like the First Amendment and the press and, you know, with the internet. It's very different now from what it was in the 1770s or the 1780s. So what the conservatives do is they pretend to appear into the minds of the founders. And if it achieves a conservative policy aim, they'll say, well, this is what they were thinking, or this is exactly as it was in the 1780s. But if it doesn't achieve a policy aim, they'll be like, well, you know, it doesn't matter what was in the minds of the founders or how you would interpret it today. What matters is like whatever society did at that time. It's an argument of convenience. But all of that aside, what they've been doing is they've been stacking the courts with these extremists who, if you, there's a whole other philosophy here called Constitution in Exile. Essentially, ever since FDR or even going back to Teddy Roosevelt with the antitrust reforms of that era, there is a segment of conservative judicial philosophy that believes that basically every congressional intervention since the 1930s or even the 1880s has been unconstitutional. And they have a perception of a constitution in exile that has, where America has been off the rails since the 1880s or the 1930s. And they've been increasingly stacking the courts with people who believe this. So ultimately, and of course the goal is not only to prevent progressives from passing any future legislation on climate change or corporate regulation or anything like this, but also to pull back on progress going back in the past, whether it's social rights, women's rights, abortion, these sorts of things, or federal power to regulate corporate industry or even taxation. So they've been doing this. And of course, recently, I think most of your listeners will be aware of the fact that McConnell, you know, forced changes in the rules so that Merrick Garland was not able to be situated on the court, took Obama's justice, and then, you know, held on. And they weren't going to allow Hillary Clinton to appoint any either. If Hillary Clinton had won, they would have stonewalled any of her justices too. They were planning on keeping a 4-4 court.
You go back to 2016 with Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
And then you go back to what Ted Cruz is doing in 2020. Why don't you share with everyone what Ted Cruz suggested if Hillary Clinton won in 2016?
Yeah, that he would basically blockade her from ever being able to have any justices come forward. He wasn't the only one, right? So there was this presumption that, oh, we'll get through the next election and Hillary Clinton will be able to nominate a replacement. But as long as conservatives held the Senate, they were never going to allow that. Their new rule, the rule that they just made up, it's Calvin Ball, for judicial politics. The new rule they made up was basically you have to control the presidency and the Senate if you want a Supreme Court justice. And that's very convenient to them, of course, because of the disproportionate representation of conservatives and rural whites in the Senate.
Right.
So they're going to get a 6-3 judiciary having stolen two justices. And then that doesn't even go back to the fact that their presidents have been winning the presidency despite losing the popular vote.
There was a line, I think it was in your piece. I read so much, I don't remember this, where you basically said there are like two ideas going into the appointment of justices. There's what is legal, the structure, and then there are the norms. Like we behave a certain way. And the Democrats have tended to sort of play a little bit, obviously by the structure, but then also they sort of played by the norms. You know, I'll find someone more reasonable. I won't find the youngest liberal progressive I could possibly find, whatever. And what we find with the Republicans is there are no norms. What they do is they find any aspect of the law that will permit them to exercise the brute authority that they have so that they technically could prevent the next president from ever appointing a justice in the Supreme Court. They could, in fact, slam dunk and then fill the bench with whatever they want. And so I think what people have to start thinking about is, so there's something wrong because the norms aren't protecting us anymore. There is no such thing as norms. And then we have to start looking at the structure, and the structure now is going to have to define what we do with the bench. And frankly, that's not a bad thing, because what do they say in architecture? Function follows form. And right now our form is defective because we can see it by what the Republicans have done.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is such a difficult topic to explore, because the things that are broken in American democracy are a series of interlocking puzzle pieces. And trying to solve one leads you back to having to solve the previous one, leads you back to having to solve the previous one. One of the challenges we're dealing with the courts is, you know, Marbury versus Madison gave us the concept of judicial review. Most people seem to think that's a good thing, right? The challenge is the founders had this idea that the legislative branch and the executive branch would preserve their own prerogatives and go against each other. That has turned out not to, in fact, be the case. What has functionally happened is political parties are the check and balance on each other. And the way we've structured our winner-take-all system is that only two parties can functionally exist, because of Duverger's law and the incentives around a winner-take-all system. You put that together and you have a situation where the only thing, the previous norm, previous comfortable norms of American democracy are almost kind of an accident. We had a very unhealthy situation from the 1770s through to the 1860s, where the halls of Congress became increasingly violent between the slave states and the non-slave states. You then had a civil war. You had a breakdown of the order, and you had a literal civil war. You then had Reconstruction and another breakdown of the order with Reconstruction. So after Reconstruction, you had a small period where the Democrats were aligned with racists. You had Dixiecrats and social conservative racists in the South aligned with the Democrats and with social liberals in the North. And then you had social liberal Republicans aligned with economic royalists. You had functionally four political parties, and that obscured the divisions between the parties all the way through the 1960s with the civil rights era. Since the 1960s and forward, you have now had a more naturalization of the two parties, where the social liberals and the economic liberals are now on one side with the Democrats, not as far left as many progressives might like, but you know, the party is getting there.
Yeah.
And then economic and social conservatives on the right-hand side. As that has happened, which is actually kind of healthy because it's accountability in a democracy, as that has happened, you've had polarization. And unfortunately, the systems the founders put in place, the Senate, the House, all of these sort of competing systems where it makes it very hard to pass legislation, combines with the filibuster and other more novel kinds of impediments to create a situation where Congress can't pass legislation. And with Congress unable to pass legislation, judicial review, Marbury versus Madison, means that functionally speaking, judges are the only ones who can enact and go forward with major legislation. What that means is that courts are the most important thing. And McConnell has rightly realized that he's willing to trade an entire election cycle to get another Supreme Court justice, because that will actually advance conservative policy. With that understood, Democrats absolutely have to realize the stakes here and understand that the norms are gone. You have pure power dynamics between the two parties.
Right.
Judges are super important. You have to end the filibuster. You have to rebalance the courts. It's what you have to do or democracy can't survive.
So I'm going to go back to what Matt Stoller said the other day. And he said, but Congress hasn't been doing its job. It hasn't been passing legislation. You know, basically, it's been at least, especially during the McConnell years, all it is a rubber stamp for the courts. That has been the sort of raison d'etre of the last couple of years. But what makes me afraid is that you and I both know, even if it was 75% of the House and the Senate were all Democrats, they're not going to write perfect legislation. There is going to be flaws. There is going to be compromise. And that, therefore, any piece of legislation couldn't ultimately, you know, be ripe for the courts to sort of reinterpret, especially if they're conservative courts. So they can take that comma and they can turn it into a completely different piece of legislation based on their interpretation. And that's exactly what McConnell is banking on, that even if the Democrats try to rewrite things or codify things or do whatever, that, you know what, by definition, legislation has the potential for being redefined by an aggressive court. And what he's looking at, especially with the Supreme Court and some of the courts of appeals, is that you will have people that will define regulation and legislation in a way that doesn't necessarily match the initial intent, but in fact could be interpreted that way. Is that correct?
And it's almost impossible to predict what kinds of novel crazy arguments they're going to come out with, right? Just, I mean, few people could have predicted the way that conservatives would attack the ACA and the lawsuit they're bringing forward. And no judge looking at balls and strikes, no judge looking in a halfway realistic way at these cases would ever come down on the conservative side. These are very radical kinds of lawsuits they're bringing based on complete misinterpretations. So it's very different. How do you write legislation that will stand up to just Looney Tunes kinds of arguments that conservative lawyers will make that should, in theory, be laughed out of court, except for the fact that you have radical extremist right-wing judges who are not looking at the law. They're looking to achieve whatever the conservative outcome is. It's impossible to write legislation in such a way that you can always protect yourself. And the very act of attempting it would hamper the ability of your legislation to be effective. You can't write effective climate change legislation that isn't going to step on some corporation's prerogative in a way that a conservative judge might deny you. There's no way.
All right, so we're talking with David Atkins. He wrote a piece entitled "Republicans Have Already Packed the Courts. It's up to the Democrats how to rebalance them, and the press should not play accomplice to the GOP efforts to change the subject."
Before you move on, Arnie, can I just say to Dave about that last point? It's better to have Congress and the administrative agencies making regulations and statutes in the first instance and having the conservative courts interpret them rather than what we have now, which is the Republicans in both the administrative branch and in the legislative branch making bad choices and having the courts just rubber stamp them. And the other thing, the more important point, though, is that after the court misinterprets Congress's legislation, Congress can correct it, like the Lilly Ledbetter case, which basically overturned a Supreme Court decision where they tried to do exactly that, to reinterpret in a bad way the legislation. And Congress said, no, that's not, here's what we mean.
Sure. But, you know, obviously that wastes everyone's time and it may not be politically feasible, right? I mean, to fix the ACA, like, is the first thing that the Biden administration is going to do to go back and try to fix the ACA? I mean, and we only have 10 years to fix climate change, right? Or to just get ourselves on a better path on climate change. You know, if you have a climate change law that's incredibly difficult to pass with a Democratic Senate, and you can't always know that you're going to be in charge of the presidency and the Senate all the time. So if you always have a court who's always overturning you, that's just another barrier to being able to get anything done at a time when the American public doesn't pay close super attention to all this stuff. They just expect us to get things done. And so if Democrats are in power, whatever they tried to do didn't seem to be possible to get done. So, you know, because a court overturned it or whatever, you're going to get Republicans back in charge at some point. And, you know, they know that. So it's a permanent blockade on the system.
But if you expand the size of the Supreme Court, let's have a come to Jesus moment here. How many cases do they actually get? 80, 90? Where is the real Supreme Court? It's the Court of Appeals. And they're all over the place. Now, what are we going to do? Are we going to pack the Court of Appeals? Are we going to expand the number of Court of Appeals? What do we do? Because we're all focused on the Supremes as if that's the issue. Most cases don't even get to the Supreme Court. Most cases are going to get thrown out or decided at the Court of Appeals level. So my question then becomes, let's say you want to expand the court, add two or three seats, whatever the number is, I don't care. But that still leaves me with a Court of Appeals that has been packed by the Republicans for decades. So is there some other answer here? Is this why the idea of term limits becomes something important? What can we do about what's currently on the bench that isn't a Supreme Court resolution, but does look at what basically has infected the rest of the court system?
Yeah, look, I always say rebalance the courts. I use plural precisely because it's not just the Supreme Court. It's the lower courts also. But there's a couple of virtuous circles here, actually. Number one is the lower courts are actually overwhelmed with cases, right? And the lower courts, unlike the Supreme Court, can hear things en banc, which is, you know, you have a small number of judges because they have so much to get through. They can't have the full court handle everything. If you had more judges on these lower courts, just from a purely nonpartisan perspective, these lower courts do need more judges to be able to get through the work in a better way. That's number one. Number two, conservatives in a lot of places, both in terms of appeals courts and in terms of state Supreme Courts, have already over the past decade actively been attempting to and sometimes succeeding in restricting the number of justices, adding justices. They have been messing with the numbers on some of these courts as well. So it's a good thing as a matter of general principle to be increasing judges to the number of these courts. It's obviously something the Democrats are going to need to do because conservatives have been already stacking them. And I think that number three, you know, there have been a range of solutions being advocated. Like maybe we don't need to add judges. Maybe we can do a term limits kind of situation. The problem is if you do a term limits that's retroactive so that you're forcing a bunch of judges off the bench immediately, that's pretty radical, right? I think it would be more radical, frankly, than just expanding the number of judges on the courts. But if you don't do it, if you say, okay, we're going to fix this so that the problem fixes over time, a decade from now, we don't have a decade is the problem. So, you know, but yeah, we need to expand the numbers, not just on the court, but in the lower courts too.
Okay, instruct me on this. Where do we get the number of judges? I mean, who sets the number? How do you increase it? How difficult is it? Because look at our population. Our population has increased in size. By definition, you would want the judicial system to increase in size. So my question is, what kind of an accordion is this system? And how have the Republicans been successful at actually reducing the number of judges at a time when clearly you want people to have more access to the judicial system? And the most fair thing would to make sure you have enough judges to address the issues at hand.
Yeah. And again, I apologize for the noise. This wasn't supposed to start just yet. But yeah, look. The challenge is with regard to the number of judges. Congress sets the number of Supreme Court judges.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that Congress sets the number of lower court judges as well. I'm getting beyond my expertise here. Okay. Obviously, the states set their number of state Supreme Court justices as well. The challenge is that if you don't do it, you're going to have... If you don't expand the numbers, you have too many cases down at the low side, and you're going to have conservative veto on everything that progressives tried to do over the next 30 years. So I don't see that there's really a legitimate alternative here.
And there was an article at the National Geographic that I looked at, and the article at the National Geographic basically said, look, we have addressed the number of judges on the bench a number of times. This is not a case of first impression. So wake up and smell the coffee, okay? And given what I read in The Nation by Ilie Mostel, he said, so what if you have two and they want to add two and you add three and you get to 15 or you get to 18? He said, here's the beauty of having a number of justices on the Supreme Court. He said, if one dies, it's not so catastrophic. And that is so true. Look what happened. One justice died. We knew she was living on air. It was a thread that RBG was, you know, basically maintaining her pulse. And nobody could imagine life without her. But it was sort of being, you know, we were in la la land not to think that that was going to happen. And look at the consequences of this. Now, my other question is that even if you put something into law, you and I both know that what's in law today is not in law tomorrow. So what are you suggesting is that we expand it, and that by the time the maybe the Republicans come back in, they can't remove those justices. They may change the law, but they can't remove the justices. And frankly, they won't change the law because they're going to want to use it to their benefit as well. So just by changing it, you've already changed the conversation and the dynamic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, look, I mean, the thing is, right now you have a situation where a small number of people, some of them septuagenarians, some of them octogenarians, like the entire balance of democracy hinges on their life expectancies and whether they get diseases or not. Like, that's a serious problem. That's not democracy, right? As Ellie Mistel said, like, if you expand the number of judges, the health of any one judge is reduced. Yes, there is in theory a problem where if each side does this tit for tat, you get a Supreme Court that's like 60 judges or whatever. Yeah, that's potentially a problem, but it's less of a problem than the current situation, which is that no one can pass any laws and you have this conservative veto over anything that's possible. And when one side wins an election, there's nothing they can actually functionally do, right? Yeah. It's actually not a terrible outcome if the voters pick a party, be it the Republicans or the Democrats, with a trifecta: White House, Senate, House of Representatives, that they get to also, given that judges are the ones creating most of the law right now, that they also get to have judges that will create the law in their favor. And look, if the Democrats screw up so badly that Republicans get another trifecta in the presidency, Senate, and the House, especially if they're able to do that after we fix the voting rules in this country, then so be it. Then they should be able to get the government that the people voted for. Exactly. And the good thing about that is there will actually be accountability in the democratic system. So then, okay, if what that means is they get rid of Social Security, that sucks. But at the very least, we don't have a situation where Republicans are always trying to get rid of Social Security. They don't succeed, and the voters don't know who to hold accountable for the problems that they have.
Right. Let me just throw one fly into this ointment, though, David, and that is, you're right about people winning the elections, and democracy would say that the party that wins the two houses of Congress and the presidency should get to just do whatever they want. But majority rule is fine so far as it goes, but we also have to protect minority rights. Footnote 4 of Caroline Products, you know, the Supreme Court case from the 1890s, the majority can't just bully over the minority. And so that's what the Constitution and courts have also fundamentally protected, not just to go along with whatever the elected majority this time wants to do.
Of course, and it's the function of the courts to do that, to protect minority rights. But the challenge is right now, we've got a conservative court that is not like protecting the minority right, and that is not, we have a radical conservative court already.
Right.
You have to be able to allow for some sort of progressive legislation to happen, even at the downside risk that a radical conservative government might come to power. I mean, yes, does it mean that in theory, a radical conservative government, if they take a trifecta and then they stack the courts for themselves, and then they make a bunch of radical decisions that basically turn America into fascism? It's possible, but I think that's actually less of a downside risk right now than of a completely sclerotic system that doesn't functionally work, that doesn't let us solve climate change, that threatens all of humanity, that threatens our ability to be able to get anything done in any major issue of importance, that gets people so frustrated that they are willing to take any populist solution that presents itself, even a lunatic like Donald Trump. I think that's a greater fascism.
Right, and let's be honest, this is a structure that is amenable to change. I mean, this is there's nothing that says you can't change it. They left it to say that the number of seats on the Supreme Court can be decided by Congress. Well, guess what? We can do it. So I just want everyone to know this is not illegal. This is very legal. They blew the norms and they use the law. All right, we'll change the law. That's all. All right, David Atkins, he writes for the Washington Monthly magazine, the title of his piece, Republicans have already packed the courts. It's up to Democrats how to rebalance them, and the press should not play accomplice to the GOP efforts to change the subject. Of course, this conversation is moot unless we see a change in administration and unless the Democrats take over the United States Senate. So this is a dream and not a reality. But the thing is, if you exercise the franchise, maybe the dream will come true. Thank you so much for joining us, David. I appreciate
it. Thanks, and sorry about the noise again.
Oh, no problem. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back. Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Another reminder again that we are Zooming this show on Tuesday afternoon. I love ProPublica. I love ProPublica for a lot of reasons. One, because I've met some amazing investigative reporters, but the operative word is investigative. And what ProPublica has been able to do is give great reporters time and support and opportunity to dig deep. And you really appreciate what digging deep means when you go to ProPublica, because they don't just give you a story that's been put together in 48 hours or 24 hours. They put together a story that has taken lots and lots of time. And from that time, you get fabulous information and a story that, like the story I'm about to share with you, inside the fall of the CDC, will gobsmack you, will break your heart, will make you understand you knew it was bad, but you didn't really understand how bad or why. So having laid that foundation, let me welcome to the program one of the authors of Inside the Fall of the CDC, how the world's greatest public health organization was brought to its knees by a virus, the president, and the capitulation of its own leaders, causing damage that could last much longer than the coronavirus. James Bandler is a senior reporter at ProPublica. He covers business and finance with coverage areas that include corporate investigations, resource extraction industries, and defense procurement. He's been a reporter for Fortune, the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, and of course, the great Rutland Herald, Barry Times, Argus newspapers. And at the Wall Street Journal, Bandler was a co-author of The Perfect Payday, a 2006 investigation that exposed the widespread practice of backdating stock options by business executives. And that team won the paper's first Pulitzer Prize for public service. James Bandler, you have an incredible resume, and you and your co-authors wrote an unbelievably powerful piece. So share with my audience about your approach to writing Inside the Fall of the CDC. And I may actually ask for a point of personal privilege and ask you to read the beginning of your article after you explain the sort of history and how you approached it, because I want them to hear those first couple of paragraphs, because in a lot of ways, it will wed them to your piece. Because that first couple of paragraphs, the tears were starting to stream down my face as I got so scared and yet knew I had to read the whole thing. So welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much, Arnie, for having me. It was a real, it's a real privilege to be on your show. I'm a longtime Upper Valley resident, so followed you and your political career for years. Thank you. And I'm really pleased to talk about the story.
So tell us about the assignment. When did this assignment begin? Because this is so comprehensive. There are so many pieces that you pulled together. I want to know, when did ProPublica know we need to start doing this, and then gave you the license to really do the most incredible work to pull this together?
So this is a 6 months of work of a ProPublica team that was assembled by, you know, the editor-in-chief with sort of a goal of understanding what's really happening inside this world-renowned agency and what's going on inside in the face of, you know, a pandemic, the worst pandemic in a century, and with an unusual administration, and to really tell the story of what was happening. So three senior writers were put on it. None of us public health writers, two of us business writers, one a national security writer, and then a top researcher. And we were basically told, you know, start making calls. In the early days of the pandemic, it was all over the phone. None of us had connections. So we were really starting from scratch. And I'll have to say it was really intimidating because there's also a lot of really great reporters on this beat.
Well, you know, I want you to sort of start by reading the beginning of your piece, but I'm going to read where I want you to end, because I want people to understand what you wrote, which is why after I read the beginning story, which just broke my heart, you write, "When the next history of the CDC is written, 2020 will emerge as perhaps the darkest chapter in its 74 years, rivaled only by its involvement in the infamous Tuskegee experiment, in which federal doctors withheld medicine from poor Black men with syphilis, then tracked their descent into blindness, insanity, and death." That, folks, is in this article. That is in the beginning of this article. They start with a story, and then we get to that paragraph, and then you realize, I have to keep going. I need to know more. James, I'm going to ask a favor. I want you to begin by reading a couple of those sort of initial paragraphs so people understand why you could put that connection to Tuskegee in this piece, because I think even to some extent, the three of you must have been quite shocked and appalled by what you found.
Okay. Well, at 7:47 a.m. on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, Dr. Jay Butler pounded out a grim email to colleagues at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Butler, then the head of the agency's coronavirus response, and his team had been trying to craft guidance to help Americans return safely to worship amid worries that two of its greatest comforts, the chanting of prayers and singing of hymns, could launch a deadly virus into the air with each breath. The week before, the CDC had published its investigation of an outbreak in an Arkansas church that had resulted in four deaths. The agency's scientific journal recently had detailed a super spreader event in which 52 of the 61 singers at a 2.5-hour choir practice developed COVID-19. Two died.
Let me just repeat that because I want people to hear the number. The agency's scientific journal recently had detailed a super spreader event in which 52 of the 61 singers at a 2.5-hour choir practice developed COVID-19, two died. 52 of the 61, James. Oh my God. All right, keep going. That number was like shocking.
Butler, an infectious disease specialist with more than three decades of experience, seemed the ideal person to lead the effort. Trained as one of CDC's elite disease detectives, he'd helped the FBI investigate the anthrax attacks. He'd led the distribution of vaccines during the H1N1 flu pandemic when demand far outstripped supply. But days earlier, Butler and his team had suddenly found themselves on President Donald Trump's front burner when the president began publicly agitating for churches to reopen. That Thursday, Trump had announced that the CDC would release safety guidelines for them very soon. He accused Democratic governors of disrespecting churches and deemed houses of worship essential services. Butler's team rushed to finalize the guidance for churches, synagogues, and mosques that Trump aides had shelved in April after battling the CDC over the language. Reviewing a raft of last-minute edits from the White House, Butler's team rejected those that conflicted with CDC research, including a worrisome suggestion to delete a line that urged congregations to consider suspending or at least decreasing the use of choirs. On Friday, Trump's aides called the CDC repeatedly about the guidance, according to emails. Why is it not up, they demanded, until it was posted on CDC website that afternoon. The next day, a furious call came from the office of the vice president. The White House suggestions were not optional. The CDC's failure to use them was insubordinate, according to emails at the time. 15 minutes later, one of Butler's deputies had the agency's text replaced with the White House version. The danger of singing wasn't mentioned. Early that Sunday morning, as Americans across the country prepared excitedly to return to houses of worship, Butler, a churchgoer himself, poured his anguish and anger into an email to a few colleagues. I am very troubled on this Sunday morning that there will be people who will get sick and perhaps die because of what we were forced to do, he wrote.
And then, of course, you then use the comment about the infamous Tuskegee experiment. And that was the opening story. So, James, you spent months, you started, I mean, one of the lines that I love was about the one of the doctors who back in December of 2019 notices some interesting pneumonias happening in Wuhan and knowing that there's something we need to follow. So we go back to brilliant people at the CDC who are so smart, who are looking everywhere all the time, and they see this happening. And she knows we need to figure this out. So take us back to that December of 2019 and then sort of help us devolve what happened as brilliant scientists knew something was wrong. But at every turn, the door was shut. The rug was pulled out. They were told they could not proceed. And of course, when you realize the relationship between China and the United States, it only added to the failure.
So this was something when the first sort of inklings that there was a problem in China came. This was a drill that this team at CDC and indeed in the federal government had been preparing for really since the anthrax attacks. And this was something that was not unexpected. There was always a thought that there could be a big one coming. The assumption had been that it would be similar to the 1918 flu. But at CDC, there was a team, a crack team, and they were all under initially the top civil servant at CDC was a doctor named Ann Schuchat. And she's best known, sort of is famous in a way, for she was played by Kate Winslet in the movie Contagion. She's the virus hunter, you know, that they based the character in the Soderbergh film on Ann Schuchat, who played a role in China in fighting the SARS outbreak in 2003. And assembled here were some of the best sort of minds in disease fighting. And they all acted as you'd expect them to do at this sort of this sense of menace in China. They didn't know it would be the big one, but immediately the machinery sprung into action. It started with just a 4 cases of unexplained pneumonia in Wuhan, China. And it was such a sort of banal warning. It followed a warning in a news bulletin about red blotch disease in the grape industry. So, but they had enough sort of sensory, they'd done this enough to know that pneumonia outbreak in China could be something you want to pay attention to, a novel pneumonia.
And see, that to me is what's so amazing about the level of brilliance. Do you know what I mean? That she really is this. She smells it, she sees it, something that you and I would never even respond to. And yet part of the problem, I think, James, is that when you realize that you need to then have a relationship with China, you need to have a relationship with the Chinese CDC, and then you look at what's happening with Donald Trump and China, you realize that, you know, the Chinese are already not, how do I say it? They're not wanting to be forthcoming. That's sort of their nature. It's sort of how they control their population. So I think the Wuhan pandemic that eventually we saw happening in Wuhan with coronavirus was much more horrific. They even kept it from their own people. My daughter lives in Shanghai, James. My daughter, I mean, every rumor that you heard in the United States, my daughter heard first, okay, in China, you know, where it was coming from. So they wanted to sort of tap it down, but that means that they also weren't forthcoming. But on top of that, we were not supportive of being able to access and share information with China as well. Am I correct?
I think that's true. I mean, it's hard to say what There were so many factors contributing to the world's lack of knowledge of it. Some of it is that China is, as you mentioned, a really secretive place now, and it's become more secretive. Exactly. So that played a part of it. And then sort of the breakdown in U.S.-China relations, that certainly played a part of it. It was a combination of forces that made it the world slow to really know what was happening. And it wasn't all, you know, Trump's fault either. You had a regime that was very secretive too.
So let's talk a little bit about one of the stories that we heard a lot about was that the testing. And we know that the WHO had a test and offered us the test, but then we were doing our own test. Tell us what the hell happened. Again, a world-renowned organization that has done these kinds of things, that shares tests with the world, how did they screw up, James? I mean, again, I keep reading every page was like, oh my God, it was not a comedy of errors. It was just an incredible failure at every level because everybody was sprinting to respond both to a political administration and to a pandemic. And yet at the same time, they were doing things that if they sort of took a breath, they would never have done, James.
I think that's true. And I think it underscores sort of the pressure this group was under and the potential risks of some of the manufacturing process they attempted, they were aware of. Documents show and our interviews show, but at the same time, they had a series of really bad choices. So they could have contracted some of this manufacturing out, but it would have taken longer. And there's a sense everyone on this team and everyone at the CDC knew that time is of the essence and every day you lose is a day the disease could be spreading in the US. So it does seem in retrospect, like everything that could go wrong did go wrong. But it also, you know, the more reporting we did and the more sort of we looked at what they were going through, the more you understand how these things can happen.
It doesn't help when you have an administration that one doesn't respect the science, that wants you to come up with the answer, that's been trashing the WHO, that talks about the Chinese virus, the Wuhan virus. I mean, when you look at what the pressure was on them to achieve a result, and yet the political pressure that was on them, where instead of collaborating, instead of working with the WHO, that somehow they had to do their own thing. And of course, part of their own thing is that an agency that's been so underfunded for so long. And the idea that somehow you can work with these private partners as if these private partners basically will be able to sort of assist you in a way that you needed at a time when time was of the essence.
So I think the problems were bigger than in this lab. The truth of the matter is as Anthony Fauci has said, we have a lousy system. Yes. For distributing these tests in a mass market. And we've seen how other countries like South Korea were able to get testing up very quickly and be testing 10,000 people a day. And some of it was, you know, the mistakes that occurred in the lab, they were terrible. They were embarrassing for the CDC. It created another excuse for the administration to marginalize them.
Exactly. But
they were part of a much bigger problem in the US with both healthcare delivery and how we fight against these infectious diseases. And that's going to be something that, you know, as we sort of do the autopsies of what happened in this catastrophe, that's one of the most important things we can address.
So another one of your sort of side stories, there are so many of them, was the story of the cruise line industry. So what I remember from the cruise line industry is that Donald Trump didn't want them to come off the boats because if they came off the boats, his numbers would increase. So for him, it was better for them to sort of stay on the cruise ships and die there than to die back, you know, on terra firma. But there was so much going on with the cruise lines that I think people don't know. Can you share before you go at least a little bit about that storyline? Because everybody remembers it, but they don't know the details that you put into it.
And it's funny you bring up his comments about wanting people on the boats. When he delivered those, if you go look on YouTube, he was standing in the very lab where a lot of the test kit manufacturing took place. And while he was sort of opining on cruise ships, he also was talking about how, you know, fantastic the CDC's test was. It was a long, you know, he gave a long and very Trumpian sort of press conference there. But the cruise ship thing was caused a lot of anguish internally at CDC, because these ships, you could describe them as like floating petri dishes or floating nursing homes, because the populations are so old, but they contain in very close quarters some of the most vulnerable populations. And once this first outbreak occurred off of Japan, the Diamond Princess, which we all watched on television, right, we saw sort of unfolding to our very eyes just how virulent this virus was and how fast it could spread. But what was amazing was after the passengers were repatriated, other cruise ships kept going out. And there were the scientists at CDC who were in charge of sort of making sure that viruses don't spread and aren't brought into this country, this division of global migration, they wanted to stop sailing. And they pleaded with the White House task force to stop. And it went on long, way too long. Ships went out, and it became so anguishing that at one point the head of global migration, according to people we talked to, was so anguished, and he's like, "This is unconscionable," right, and he's just begging for them to stop sailing.
And yet, here's the interesting thing: so you have these death ships, which is really what they were. I mean, let's be honest here. And then there were a couple pieces that I came out of your article that when they took them off the cruise ships, let's tell people what they did. I mean, they didn't separate them. I mean, the idea, from the healthy and the unhealthy. I mean, it was in a lot of ways, nobody was protected from anybody, because they put them on planes with shower curtains between them, and the shower curtains didn't even come up to the top. So that, you know, and we're thinking about a plane. If you think a cruise ship has circulating air, an airplane is a little tube. And I'm thinking, and we were telling people that this was okay, that they would be safe. The CDC must be slitting their wrists as they were watching this.
So it was one senior CDC person who I talked to said, if he were to write a book, it would begin with this chapter, and it would be called Operation Clusterfuck. And again, it was a classic case of, you know, a well-intentioned desire by bureaucrats at State Department and at the ASPR to bring, ASPR is the lead response agency at HHS, to bring people home, which is a good, well-intentioned thing. But on the way to the airport, they learned that 14 passengers had tested positive. There'd been a pledge that those passengers would not go on the same plane, a fly out with non-infected passengers. But it was so helter-skelter that State Department and HHS decided they would put them all on the same plane. And this was over the very loud objections of senior CDC scientists, including Dr. Shookit. So they put them on planes, and the only divider was, you know, what was described to us as a plastic sheet that could have been a shower curtain from Home Depot with this 4-foot gap. And again, it was not the best chapter, and you know.
And let's also remember that this was also an opportunity for, again, politics to enter the whole way of fighting the pandemic, because, you know, you're not going to stop the cruise ships, and he's going to genuflect to the cruise line industry. But then what is he going to do? He's going to order the border shut between Mexico and Canada. Okay, so he turns it into an excuse for his, you know, brutish immigration policy. So, you know, we know that we've created death boats. We say, oh, not a problem. We're not even quite sure what, you know, closing down the border is between Canada and Mexico is going to do, but it fits into his political agenda.
So that was to us one of the most troubling and wrenching parts of the story. And it was the use of, and it's anyone who studied immigration history knows that sort of the menace of disease and vector, often immigrants are scapegoated for this. It happened in the 1890s with Jewish immigrants coming to New York. And it happened again in this case with stigmatization of Hispanics, who people in the administration were convinced or wanted the public to believe were going to be great sources of coronavirus. And so for the first time, you know, the U.S. is this awesome power. The CDC has few powers, explicit powers, but one of them is the ability to shut borders and also to control migration in the event of an outbreak, and also to and to quarantine people if to protect public health. And in this case, this power was used over the objection of the head of quarantine to issue this order on the southern border, with a claim that, you know, senior CDC scientists knew was false, that the southern border was in crisis because of COVID. And there was no evidence of this medically at the time, and yet it happened.
And all I'm going to do is I have to let you go, James. This should have been a 2 hour. This should have been a 2 hour interview.
All right. Well, thank you. I hope I didn't drone on too long.
No. But all I want people to understand is that there's one segment in the story where you talk about the immigration, and then we find out is that we let a dog in, but we don't let humans in. That's all I'm going to tell you. You got to read the piece at ProPublica. As soon as you read it, you will understand exactly why there's a connection between a dog in Africa and what they were doing with this immigration policy. It is an amazing piece at ProPublica. James Miller is one of the three fabulous writers for this. And I'm so grateful that you did it, because the CDC, will it recover? I don't know. Must it recover? It has to, James. It has to. Thank you very much. And tell the people at ProPublica, thank you for existing, because they allow you to do the work you do.
Thanks so much, Arnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was a pleasure. This Bye-bye. Is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. We are